final introduction which they sent and which you also received, Rabbi Joshua Garraway, PhD, serves as the Saul and Arlene Bronstein Professor of Judeo-Christian Studies and Professor of Early Christianity and Second Commonwealth at the Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion's Los Angeles campus. Dr. Michael Peppard is here with his wife, Rebecca. Where's Rebecca? Welcome. Is a scholar and teacher who brings to light the meanings of the New Testament and other early Christian materials and their social, political, artistic, and ritual contexts. They will be speaking together three times this weekend, this Shabbat: Judaism and Christianity in the Making, How Ancient Jews and Christians Did Similar Things in Dissimilar Ways. Tonight is the first session, and tomorrow they'll continue with, in the morning, reimagining Passover with Easter and the Seder. And after lunch, everyone is invited to stay for lunch. After lunch, creating rituals of belonging, circumcision, baptism, and anointing. So please join me in welcoming them both. I'll speak one after the other tonight.
Can people hear me in the back?
Yes.
Okay. So over the course of our three sessions this Shabbat, Michael and I are going to be talking about Judaism and Christianity as they developed in the first few centuries of the Common Era. In so doing, we will be adopting a historical perspective that I suspect might sound unfamiliar. So let me begin our adventure this weekend by describing an important shift that has taken place in scholarship over the last generation or two. Many of us were raised to think of Judaism and Christianity as representing a mother-daughter relationship. Judaism is the original religion, the mother, which in the first century gave rise to the daughter religion, Christianity, just as it would do to another daughter religion, Islam, 6 centuries later. Today, however, historians are more apt to see Judaism and Christianity as having a sibling relationship. Christianity and Judaism are sister religions, both born out of watershed events in Roman-occupied Jerusalem of the first century. The first event was the ministry, the death, and, according to Christians, the resurrection of a Jewish teacher called Jesus of Nazareth. Jews who believed that Jesus had, in fact, been raised from the dead were forced to consider how this remarkable event could be squared with Jewish history up to that point. The result of their centuries-long deliberations became Christianity. The second event occurred a generation later, in 70 CE, when an ill-advised war waged by Jews against Rome ended with the Romans sacking Jerusalem and burning the temple to the ground, leaving nothing but the Western Retaining Wall, the so-called Western Wall that so many of us have visited in the Old City in Jerusalem. In 70, the Jewish nation lost its capital, its central religious shrine, the temple, its religious leadership, the priesthood. Out of the ashes emerged a class of intellectuals known as rabbis, who were forced to consider how the destruction of the temple and exile from their land could be squared with Jewish history up to that point. The result of their centuries-long deliberations became Rabbinic Judaism, the Judaism of the Mishnah and the Talmud, the Judaism we know simply as Judaism. Christianity and Rabbinic Judaism thus came of age alongside one another in the first and second and third centuries, endeavoring simultaneously to cultivate a religion that could make sense of a Jewish past in light of a resurrected Messiah in one case and the destruction of the temple and exile from Jerusalem on the other. It is no coincidence, therefore, that just like two siblings vying to carve out an identity that is similar but different from the other, Christians and the rabbis did many similar things in dissimilar ways. Tomorrow, for example, we will talk about how both groups transformed two important features of Jewish religion: the holiday of Passover and the initiation rite of circumcision. Incidentally, I teach at a university, so I should say, trigger warning for the second one. We're going to be talking extensively about circumcision. You know what I mean. As we will see, both the rabbis and the Christians thought extensively about what Passover and circumcision should mean in light of the events of the first century, but the results they arrived at proved remarkably different. And tonight we begin with yet a third dissimilar similarity. In this case, we acknowledge the fact that both Jesus and the rabbis relied heavily on the parable as a method of instruction. I'm going to talk for a few moments about parables as they appear in ancient Judaism. Then Michael will teach us about the parables of Jesus. They are similar, of course, but also quite different. Parables. Parables are brief, fictional stories designed to impart a lesson or value. Parables are like fables, but instead of animals, the characters are human. Instead of a tortoise and a hare teaching us that slow and steady wins the race, a parable gives us human characters, kings and servants and farmers and the like. Now, for many Jews, it comes as a surprise to learn that the rabbis taught in parables. Living in a secular Christian culture, American Jews are more familiar with the parables of Jesus, the Good Samaritan, for example, or the prodigal son. They're more familiar with those than they are with the more than 1,000 parables contained in the literature of the rabbis. Rabbis today rarely, if ever, use parables when giving sermons, or teaching lessons, or when counseling Jews in need. If we were Jews living in the second or third century, by contrast, we would expect to hear a parable in nearly every encounter with a rabbi. When we stepped foot in a synagogue or a Jewish house of study, we would have expected a rabbi to offer a mashal, the Hebrew word for parable. He would use the mashal in order to drive home his point. The rabbis used parables when they preached sermons, when they taught Torah, when they interacted with other Jews. And again, we are fortunate that more than 1,000 of those parables eventually came to be written down and preserved for us in the vast corpus of rabbinic literature known as Midrash. Now, the rabbis primarily used parables to answer questions about the meaning of passages in the Jewish scriptures. Rather than saying simply, what the Torah means here is this, the rabbis would illustrate their explanation using simple fictional narratives, parables. So consider the following example from the Ten Commandments as representative. When discussing the Ten Commandments, the rabbis ask an interesting question. Why does the Torah not begin with the Ten Commandments? After all, if the point of the Torah is to convey the laws of God, why not just start the Torah with the legislation revealed at Mount Sinai? Why did God include all the stories about the creation and the flood and the patriarchs and the slavery in Egypt and the plagues and the parting of the sea? God could have simply cut to the chase. Book 1, chapter 1, verse 1, here are the laws I expect you to follow. The rabbis explained why God delayed dispensing the Ten Commandments using a parable. It goes like this. The matter may be compared, they said, to a charismatic man who enters a city and tells its inhabitants, "Here I am ready to rule over you." Now, naturally, the citizens laugh at the man. "Who are you?" they say. "Who are you, and what reason do we have for accepting your rule?" So what does the man do? He proceeds to build a wall for the city and aqueducts to bring in water, and he leads the city's army to victory in battle. Thereafter, he returns to the inhabitants and he says, "Here I am. I'm ready to rule over you." And the inhabitants say, "Yes, yes, we accept your rule and your laws." Like most of the rabbi's parables, this one concludes with what's called the nimshal, or the explanation of the mashal. The rabbis go on to say that just as the man had to earn the respect of the city dwellers, so too did God have to earn the respect of the Israelites. Had God approached Israel with the Ten Commandments originally, they might have laughed and asked why they should be beholden to this God. Therefore, God did the cool stuff in advance. God forged the family of Israel, saved them from Egypt, split the sea for them, fed them manna and quail in the wilderness, and then God appeared at Mount Sinai to give Israel the Ten Commandments. And naturally, the Israelites said, "Heck yes, we accept your rule, and we accept your laws." As rabbinic parables go, this one is relatively simple and straightforward. The allegorical correspondence is easy to decipher. The city ruler stands for God, the inhabitants of the city stand for Israel. And the lesson, too, is easy to discern. God could not have given the Ten Commandments to the Israelites straight away, for they would not have accepted them. Only after securing their loyalty by redeeming them from Egypt could God expect them to accept the commandments. Other parables are not so simple, however. Sometimes the rabbis tinker with the correspondence between parable character and real-life object in ways that challenge listeners to think more deeply about the issue at hand. Oftentimes, careful reflection upon such parables reveals the rabbi's deep-seated anxiety over the theological implications of biblical passages. As an example, consider this tricky parable about Adam and Eve. As you may recall, the book of Genesis says that after Adam and Eve ate the forbidden fruit, their eyes were opened. "Vatipachna enei shneihem." Okay, well, what does it mean to say their eyes were opened? Surely the phrase is not to be taken literally, as if to say that Adam and Eve had been blind before they met the serpent. Rather, their eyes were opened figuratively, as the rabbis explain in a parable. The matter is comparable, they say, to a wayfarer who is window shopping along the avenue of an ancient city. He passes the shop of a glassworker. In front of the shop is a display full of beautiful goblets and vases. The man spins around and shatters the display with his cane. When the proprietor comes outside, he realizes he would never get compensation from the man for all lost merchandise. So instead, he shows him an inventory of all the beautiful wares that were destroyed. Okay, then comes the nimshal. How does this story explain the opened eyes of Adam and Eve? Well, just as the proprietor showed the man the extent of the damage he had caused, so God revealed to Adam and Eve the countless generations of human beings they had destroyed through their sin. He opened their eyes to the fact that humanity had been doomed by their transgression. On one level, again, this proprietor of the shop is God. The wayfarer represents Adam and Eve. Just as the proprietor opened the eyes of the wayfarer to the extended consequences of his error, so God opened the eyes of Adam and Eve to the historical consequences of their error. If we interrogate the parable further, however, we notice that it actually raises as many questions as it answers. Consider the wayfarer's transgression. Did he spin around to destroy the display on purpose or by accident? The rabbis don't specify, but it's hard to see why he would have done so on purpose. He's not described as a hoodlum or a street urchin or someone suffering from mental illness. But if it were an accident, does that not suggest that the sin of Adam and Eve was also an accident, or in the least, an inadvertent mistake? But if it had been an inadvertent mistake, should it have warranted, as it did, the fall of humankind? Was God's punishment, as we might put it in today's terms, a disproportionate response? And what about the proprietor's actions? What sort of glassware dealer sets up his delicate wares unprotected in the street? I'm guessing Flo from the Progressive ad would not be eager to issue this guy an insurance policy. That's my one joke. One for one, that's a thousand, I mean all of it. It's almost as if he was asking for someone to come along and break his wares. Are the rabbis then suggesting that God was likewise negligent in protecting the fruit of the forbidden tree? Did God perhaps want the first couple to commit the sin that would relegate humankind to toil and drudgery? Was it all part of God's master plan? Such questions can be multiplied and multiplied, all based on a parable of just a few lines. None of them can be answered, of course, and that's part of the beauty of the parable. On one level, the simple level, the parable resolves a curiosity in the biblical text. In this case, what does it mean to say that the eyes of Adam and Eve were opened, seeing as they were not previously blind? But on another, more nuanced and sophisticated level, the parable allows the rabbis to poke and prod at the biblical text, expressing anxieties about the fairness of God through the subtleties of allegorical correspondence, which raise questions that go unanswered. This subversive feature of the parable is expressed most magnificently in what is my favorite of all rabbinic parables, one found in the rabbi's Midrash on the book of Lamentations. Lamentations is not a book of the Torah. It is one of the five scrolls of the Jewish Bible that are read on five different holidays. The scroll of Esther is read on Purim, as we all know. The scroll of Ecclesiastes is read on Sukkot, the Song of Songs on Passover, Ruth on the holiday of Shavuot, and on Tisha B'Av, the ninth day of the month of Av, we sit in the dark and read the book of Lamentations. Lamentations reads like a funeral dirge, the heartfelt lament of a Jew, possibly the prophet Jeremiah himself, over the destruction of Jerusalem on the ninth day of the month of Av in the year 586 BCE. As it happens, Jerusalem would be sacked again by the Romans 600 years later, as I mentioned earlier, also on the ninth of Av. Now, the third chapter of Lamentations is especially moving. In it, the sorrows of Jerusalem's denizens are expressed as if concentrated in one single man. This man comes forward and shares in heartbreaking detail his misery in the wake of defeat. "I have come under the rod of God's wrath," he says. It is as if God pursues me like a hungry beast, as if God has flayed my skin and chained me up and buried me alive and pierced my flesh and on and on and on. Then, however, after 24 verses expressing his utter humiliation, the man's attitude shifts abruptly. Despite all that has befallen me, he says, this I will remember, and because of this I have hope. So what is this? Well, the remainder of the chapter suggests that this refers to the compassionate nature of God. God will eventually let Jerusalem out of its timeout, so to speak. But in the hands of the rabbis, the this in Lamentations takes on a whole new meaning. As you'd expect, the rabbis say that what the Jew remembers, the this that gives him hope, can be understood only through a parable. And the parable goes like this. Once there was a king. He married a woman, and he wrote for her the most generous ketubah marriage contract that you can possibly imagine. I will provide you with this much jewelry, this much gold, and so many dresses, and so many bedrooms. They got married. And the next day, he left on a journey to the provinces. He didn't come back. Day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year, the wife waited. The neighbors would come by to tell her that her husband had abandoned her, that she should marry another man. The ridicule brought her to tears every day, and the only thing that could console her was to take out that marriage contract and read about what the king had promised her. After many long years, lo and behold, the king returned. He said to his wife, I am amazed that you have waited for me all these years. She replied, Oh, my husband, were it not for the promises you made me in our marriage contract, the neighbors would have led me astray long ago. So what is the meaning of this parable? Who is the king? Who is the wife? Who are the neighbors? What is the marriage contract? The rabbis explain it all in the Nimshah. God, of course, is the king. The wife is Israel. The neighbors are the Gentiles who taunt Jews every day, telling them that their God has left them. And the marriage contract? The marriage contract is the Torah. And just as the woman finds consolation by poring over that contract every day, so Jews pore over the Torah every day and have hope. This is what the Jew in Lamentations 3 calls to mind. This, the Torah, is what all Jews should call to mind when in despair. The Torah, our marriage contract with God. One day, one fine day, as Madam Butterfly would say, God will return to redeem the Jewish people and make good on the promises of the Torah. In that hour, we Jews will tell God how the Torah kept us alive. It was the Torah that kept us loyal during those centuries of darkness, when the Gentiles would otherwise have led us astray. It's a lovely message. We Jews are married to God. We have a contract in the Torah, and we can rest assured that even when God seems distant, God's Torah is with us, and its promise of eventual consummation propels us through history. It's uplifting, it's inspiring, it makes me want to take the Torah out and start studying it right now. But there's also a really dark and disturbing undercurrent to this parable. Yes, it gives the assurance of redemption. And yes, It praises the Jewish people for remaining steadfast to God, even in the most trying of times. But one can also feel in this parable the sadness and the anger and the anxiety boiling just beneath the surface. Consider the character of the king. Sure, he writes a generous ketubah, and he does come back in the end. But what kind of derelict husband is this? He leaves town the day after the marriage. He doesn't write or send news of his well-being. He leaves his wife to fend for herself amidst hostile neighbors. It is impossible not to feel here the rabbi's own fear and anger over the theological abandonment indicated by their own circumstance of exile. And look at what the king says when he returns. I am astonished to see that you have waited for me all these years. Why is he astonished? Did the king, in fact, expect her to leave and marry another man? Will God be astonished to find out that we Jews have remained steadfast to the Torah all these years? Does God expect us not to be steadfast? Well, if so, what are we all doing here tonight? Again, I'm not going to answer these questions, nor do I think the rabbis wanted them answered. But the rabbis wanted to ask them, and the form of the parable provided the perfect vehicle for doing so in a way that was oblique, tantalizing and daring, but ultimately safe, because it was embedded within the more superficial act of textual interpretation. Now, I began this talk by defining a parable in rather simple terms. It's a brief, fictional story designed to impart a lesson or value. That's the kind of definition you will find if you look up the term in a dictionary, or, as I did, type parable definition into Google. What I hope my few moments with you tonight have revealed is that in the teaching of the rabbis, the parable becomes so much more than merely a fictional story designed to impart a lesson or value. In the simplest sense, the parable provides a helpful way to illustrate their interpretation of thorny verses in Scripture. But in a far more sublime sense, the parable provides the rabbis a language in which they can wrestle with some of the most challenging and enduring questions about God, Judaism, history, and human existence. The parable provides the language in which the rabbis can struggle with God. For those of you who know the Hebrew meaning of the name Israel, the rabbis' infatuation with the parable ought to make perfect sense. Yisrael in Hebrew, Israel, means the people who struggle with God. For the rabbis, the Hebrew parable, the mashal, became the hallmark expression of that struggle. Thank you.
Figured that one out.
Thank you so much for the invitation. Last time we were here, we were in the chapel in the woods, and this feels much more formal, and I'm a little nervous here out in front. But I'll do my best to settle in. I want to start by talking about my own teaching context, which is at an academic theology department here in New York at Fordham University. And it's a theology that the study of God, study of discourse about God. And I am sure that if Jesus of Nazareth walked into an academic theology department, he would have no idea what is happening. The things that we talk about, we read philosophy, we read Karl Marx, we read all kinds of literary theory. We have this highfalutin way of speaking about everything, right? And no word is too big for us, and we have to just build up jargon upon jargon. But when Jesus was asked about God, he he told the story. So the first point about Jesus and parables, and really about Jesus and theology, is that Jesus had a narrative theology. So to talk about God means to tell a story. So what are Jesus' parables? Like Josh, I have a definition, but I made my own, Josh. over the years of teaching undergraduates, I've developed this one. Short fictional narratives drawn from nature or common life or everyday life, meant to, one, elucidate moral values, so that's similar to what Josh said. But the second part, I think, is a little bit different, and it's on a handout coming around. Or two, to generate an experience for listeners that sparks active reflection about God and God's plan for humanity. So some of Jesus' parables are what I would call didactic or illustrative, or the speaker knows what the speaker wants taught and is using a story to get that thing taught back. But I think there are some of Jesus' parables that don't function like that, where Jesus as a rabbi is envisioning God and God's plan in stories, in ways that he can't say in another way. He doesn't have other language beside the story. And so we'll have an example of that in a moment. Are we okay? We might have to share, I don't know. It's a big crowd. It's a good crowd. So there's a little definition to start. I also want to start with some of my frustrations in teaching about parables and just being a Christian for all these years and going to many, many, many churches around the world and listening to many, many sermons and professors. And I'm frustrated by a few things in how parables are treated in preaching and teaching. First, I'm frustrated that often they are oversimplified to be just moral stories or merely moral stories, like fables. And I think it's secondly not acknowledged how different kinds of people hear the same story. Often we're given we're presented with the meaning of a story without realizing that a poor person or a wealthy person hears the same story differently. Or someone who's inside hears a story differently than someone who's outside of the group. And even in one's own life, as a young person or an elderly person, you can hear the same story differently. And third, I sometimes get frustrated that in our study of parables, and we hear about a king, and oh, the king is God, and we hear about a landowner, oh, the landowner is God, and we hear about his character, or the ketubah, that's the Torah, and the meaning sometimes gets frozen over time, where we're no longer really living with the story, but we've moved it into thinking about the allegory. And so I really try in my teaching to recreate the experience for listeners of what is it like if you don't know what it's supposed to be? What is it like if you don't know what the history of tradition has told you these stories are supposed to be? Are the parables unique to Jesus? Well, you already know they're not, because Josh just told you there are over 1,000 parables in the rabbinic corpus. So there's not any way to communicate in the world that is absolutely unique. It's not possible. And he's saying from the mouth, we're speaking into a genre. There are expectations of the listener. And so Jesus, of course, has expectations of how a Jewish teacher in the first century of the Common Era is supposed to talk about God and what people would understand. So famous teachings about fathers and sons and masters and slaves and merchants and landowners and people who go away for many, many years. Jesus tells those parables too. Landowners, tenant farmers, day laborers, these characters pop up in all the rabbinic parables just like they do for Jesus. But I do think there are a couple distinctive things. I don't want to say unique, but I do think distinctive about Jesus' teaching style of parables. And a couple in terms of the content of the parables, and then one idea in terms of the form of the teaching. In terms of content, Jesus' parables talk much more about processes of the natural world than do the contemporary parables of his time. So parables about seeds, parables about yeast, parables about rain and farming, parables about winemaking, all of these natural images are very prominent for him. And so his narrative theology is also a kind of ecological theology, where how does nature reveal who God is? And secondly, his parables, while they do sometimes talk about kings and big landowners, they very frequently talk about everyday common people, especially the poor and the marginalized. So God is not only a king and a landowner in Jesus' parables, but also could be a woman who is sweeping the floor of her house looking for the one coin that she lost because she needs that one coin to buy food for that day. And this can be also a God image in Jesus' parables. So a couple differences in content there. In terms of difference in form, I think a big difference about, distinct thing about Jesus teaching parables is that sometimes there is no mishal. So Josh just described the mashal and the mishal, the parable and its explanation. You know, we don't have all the texts, and sometimes we wonder if we have the text incomplete. But there are several parables of Jesus where he tells the story and just walks away. Now remember, he was very frustrating to a lot of people. So this is one of those aspects of him frustrating, I think, many of his listeners. Imagine if you left work early and you walk over a bunch of hills and you walk for several hours to go hear this new rabbi I was talking about, and he tells you a bunch of stories about seeds and farming and wine, and then doesn't tell you what any of them mean. Right, that's the kind of experience I think some people might have had. So for example, the parable of the mustard seed, which is in three of the four of the Gospels of the Christian Scriptures, one of his seed parables, he says, "The kingdom of God is like a mustard seed, which when sown upon the ground is the smallest of all the seeds on earth. Yet when it is sown, it grows up and becomes the greatest of all shrubs, and puts forth large branches, so that the birds of the air can make nests in the shade." That's it. And he walks away. And then the narrator of that gospel says, and this is how he talked all the time. He spoke like this, and then in private he would talk to his disciples further about these things. So there is no angel in that, in that example. Or as Jesus might say, do we have ears to hear? Says, Let the one who has ears to hear listen. Let the one who has ears to hear. So there's a responsibility on the part of the listener to create the meaning, to wrestle with the meaning, to struggle with the meaning, as Josh said in the etymology of instruction. Another key question for Christians over the years has been, for the listener, where do I read myself in? Where do I read myself into these stories? There are, depending on how we count, 3 dozen or so parables of Jesus, possibly more if we divide them up differently. And in some of them it's obvious where to read yourself in, but in many of them it is not at all obvious who I am supposed to be, who the listener is supposed to be. Am I the seed? Am I the soil? Am I the farmer? Am I the rain? Who am I in these stories? Am I none of the above? And so I try to think about ways that the meaning can be continually refreshed over time. That's something Judaism and Christianity share. We're always trying to refresh the meanings of our canonical texts. So one example, we're going to give two examples of major parables here. The parable of the sower and the parable of the Good Samaritan, both of which are printed on the handout. The parable of the sower is at the beginning of what is likely the oldest of areas of Jesus' life. And so in that sense, it's programmatic to say, this is how Jesus talks, and this is how he's supposed to look. Right? It's laying out a style of teaching. He began to teach beside the lake. He's always outside, by the way, basically. He's living outside, wandering around Galilee. Such a large crowd gathered around him that he got into a boat on the lake and sat there while the whole crowd was beside the lake on the land. He began to teach them many things in parables, and he said to them, "Listen, a sower went out to sow, and as he sowed, some seed fell on a path, and the birds came and ate it up. Other seed fell on rocky ground, where it did not have much soil, and it sprang up quickly, since it had no depth of soil. And when the sun rose, it was scorched. Since it had no root, it withered away. Other seed fell among thorns, and the thorns grew up and choked it, and it yielded no grain. Other seed fell into good soil and brought forth grain, growing up and increasing and yielding 30 and 60 and 100-fold. And he said, Let anyone with ears to hear listen. Now in the narrative, he doesn't at that point explain anything. As I said, he tells the story and just moves on. Or, you know, adjusts himself in his boat out there on the lake. And I like to think about, what if we didn't have any more? What might this parable mean? What could it continue to mean? I also wonder if we've given it a weird title. These titles are not ancient, they're passed on through the tradition. I think we might say it's a parable about four kinds of soil. It's really not so much about the sower at first, all he does is throw soil everywhere, throw seeds everywhere, right? Walking along, just throwing seeds. And it's sort of about, maybe it's about more about the types of soil that receive these seeds. We might think about retitling it as the parable of the reckless farmer who got lucky. Jesus is talking to other farmers. This is ridiculous. You would never do this. Seed is valuable. Grain is valuable. This is your business. Just throw seed everywhere. You can see where the road is. Why are you throwing seed on the road? Like playing roulette with seeds. But then when I think about that, that recklessness, Jesus' parables often do have a shocking moment where the realism of the everyday is broken. This doesn't make any sense for a farmer. Why would a farmer act like this? Well, if this is a story about the kingdom of God, about how God acts in the world, maybe Jesus is saying that God is a bit reckless with blessing. Maybe God is a bit reckless with, in Christian terminology, grace. God makes rain to fall on the just and the unjust. Maybe God is throwing blessing all over the place, and still, even though it lands on all of these three bad forms of ground, there's still an abundance in the end. There's an abundant harvest in the end, more abundant than expected. These are just thoughts, ways of creating meaning out of a story like this. And then we read a little bit later in that chapter, and Jesus pulls his small disciples aside. Hey guys, and also you very much. Hey everybody, here's what I think. So we get a private teaching, which is there on the handout as well, an allegorical interpretation. He's frustrated. He says, how do you understand all these parables? Don't you understand this one? The sower sows the word, the message that goes out. These are the ones on the path where the word is sown. When they hear, Satan immediately comes and takes away the word that is sown in them. And these are the ones sown on rocky ground. When they hear the word, they immediately receive it with joy. But they have no root and endure only for a while. Then, when trouble or persecution arises on account of the word, immediately they fall away. And others are those sown among the thorns. These are the ones who hear the word. But the cares of the world and the lure of wealth and the desire for other things come in and choke the word, and it yields nothing. And these are the ones sown in the good soil. They hear the word and accept it and bear fruit 30 and 60 and 100 fold. That's a quite detailed interpretation. I don't know that I would have got all of that without the secondary private instruction or teachings. And so as a historian who studies the development of Christian texts, we often look at this allegorical interpretation and say that this is a development of teaching. It doesn't mean that it's not what Jesus meant, but it's certainly very, very particular. It talks about persecution. It talks about something that feels like it would come later in the early Christian story. It also presumes that within a community of these early followers of Jesus, these early Christians, that they are struggling with all these types, the types who convert quickly and then fall away, or the types who are convert, but then they realize they're supposed to share their wealth, and then they're pulled away because they don't want to share all their wealth with this small community. So we have these different levels of interpreting of the parable like the parable of the sower. Trying to understand what it might have meant in Jesus' own mouth with his own close disciples, what it might have meant in that early community of Christians, and then how it continues to create meaning up to today. But to look at that latter part of how parables can continue to create meaning, I want to shift to this message. We have some great, great classic examples of different interpretations of the same text. So when I was talking to God after planning this, he thought the Good Samaritan might be the one parable that that most people knew, right? There's often in every major city a place called Samaritan House or something like that that is for the poor or for weary travelers. So let's look at the Good Samaritan. It's only preserved in the Gospel according to Luke, where there's a discussion where a scholar of the law, a Jewish scribe, stands up to test him, to check his knowledge, and says, "Teacher, what must I do to inherit eternal life?" And Jesus said to him, "What's written in the law? How do you read it?" And he said in reply, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, and with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself." Sounds familiar. And he replied to him, "You've answered correctly. Do this and you will live." But because he wished to justify himself or make sure he was right, he said to Jesus, "And who is my neighbor?" And this is a very Jewish forbidden question. I mean, this is the question of the love commandment, right? How far does neighbor love extend? Jesus answers with a story. A man fell victim to robbers as he went down from Jerusalem to Jericho. They stripped and beat him and went off, leaving him half dead. A priest happened to be going down that road, but when he saw him, he passed by on the opposite side. Likewise, a Levite came to the place, and when he saw him, he passed by on the opposite side. The rule of three in folk tales, it might get priest, Levite, and kind of Joe Israel. Like, just your average...
Wait, there's another name for Joe Israel, right? I don't know, there's some,
it's not a Joe, but, yeah.
Plumbing,
okay. So, kind of a regular person, right? You got these two officials, and then but Jesus doesn't do that. It's not priest, Levite, and regular man or woman. It's a Samaritan. A neighbor, yes, a neighboring region, but a region that has had a history of violence with Judea. A Samaritan traveler who came upon him was moved with compassion at the sight. He approached the victim, poured oil and wine over his wounds, and bandaged them. Then he lifted him up on his own animal, took him to an inn, and cared for him. The next day he took out two silver coins and gave them to the innkeeper with the instruction, "Take care of them. If you spend more than what I have given you, I shall repay you on my way back." End of the parable there. Which of these three, in your opinion, was neighbor to the robber's victim? And the other man answered, "The one who treated him with mercy." And Jesus said to him, "Go and do likewise." So this is his main explication, his main interpretation of the love commandment. It seems simple. Go and do likewise. If there is a parable meant to be imitated, this is the one. It ends with, go do this, right? Seems like we are the Samaritan. We're supposed to be the Samaritan. We're supposed to challenge the expectations of social divisions, reach out to a supposed enemy with material aid, and give that material aid beyond what is even reasonable. Not just the help, but also here's extra money, here's a place, until you convalesce, until you get well. But over a time of reflection and in preaching and just in living, all of us, we think, well, what if you're in a hurry to take care of your own sick daughter? Or what if it's a dark alley? What if you fear that there's a trap? What if you think this person is lying there to try to catfish you and rope you in? Or what if you're in the ditch? What does the parable of the Good Samaritan mean if you're the one in the ditch, if you're not the traveler on the road? And in fact, the oldest artistic rendering of this story, which is on the front of the handout, it's a little hard to see, I know, from one of our earliest Christian illuminated manuscripts with some pictures of illustrating the stories. The Good Samaritan is allegorically interpreted as Jesus, who is helping the traveler on the ground with the aid of an angel who's there. But I like the title at the top, and if your ancient Greek is rusty, I'll help you out on the top of that. It's a little hard to read. But the Greek there titles it the one about the guy who fell among thieves. The parable, meaning the parable about the person who was in the ditch. And this struck me as very meaningful to me because it shows that either way we title these parables influences our overall interpretation. It's kind of the view from below, or the view from the ditch, the one in need of salvation, was the operative meaning for many, many early Christians. I want to switch now to two interpretations of the Good Samaritan by two famous Christians. St. Augustine, a bishop from North Africa, 4th to 5th century, and Martin Luther King Jr. Yes, the holiday did inspire me a little bit to think about putting these two together, but you'll see why I want to do so. And this is how we'll conclude. Two very different methods that I want you to hold side by side. St. Augustine, he is a bishop, a theologian, a philosopher, and he interprets this parable in a famous sermon as a full-blown allegory that is about the history of Christian salvation. And I've given you some of the allegorical correspondence here on the handout where the traveler on the road is Adam. This is humanity traveling the road. And Jerusalem is the heavenly city, right up high on the hill, and going down to Jericho. And the thieves are the devil, and the devil's workers are angels. They strip the traveler of immortality, they beat him to persuade him to sin, and leave him half dead in a sinful state. And then the law and the prophets pass by. Jesus ends up saving the traveler, and my favorite part, and I'm guessing Josh is too, since we studied Paul together, that Jesus hands off humanity to Paul, this apostle, and he says, you're going to take care of humanity for a while, I have to go. So this is an allegory of doctrine, Christian doctrine of history of salvation, and it's quite elegant in its form. A very, very different type of interpretation. I was going to summarize, but I thought, since Shira said it was appropriate, it was an audio system, I thought we could actually listen to it. It's only about 4 minutes. Martin Luther King Jr., as you know, was a pastor. He became famous as a civil rights activist, but primarily he was a pastor and a scholar of the Bible. April 3rd, 1968, that date means a lot to you, to anyone, because this was his last speech. Virtually everyone in the United States has heard the last minute of this speech. This is the I've Been to the Mountaintop speech. And this is a riveting moment where he prophesies his own death and he's assassinated to find the next day. But in the middle of the speech, given for a strike in support of sanitation workers in Memphis, in the middle of the speech, he pauses for a few minutes to interpret this parable. He didn't have to, right? He's choosing a text to use for this occasion. And as you listen, I'd like you to think about why he chose this parable, how he engages with the history and the historical context of it, and then how does he, and this is the crucial interpretive part, how does he encourage the listener to read themselves in different ways, instead of just being the Samaritan or the guy in the ditch. Here we go. Ready? We're going to do this, Jordan. You ready? So, high tech.
Let us develop a mind of dangerous unselfishness. One day a man came to Jesus. He wanted to raise some questions about some vital matters of life. Of course, he wanted to trick Jesus and show him that he knew a little more than Jesus knew and throw him off base. Now that question could have easily ended up in a philosophical and theological debate. But Jesus immediately pulled that question from midair and placed it on a dangerous curve between Jerusalem and Jericho. He talked about a certain man who fell among thieves. You remember that Levite? The priest passed by on the other side. They didn't stop to help him. Finally, a man of another race came by. He got down from his beast, decided not to be compassionate by proxy. But he got down with him, administered first aid, and helped the man in need. Jesus ended up saying, this was the good man, this was the great man. Because he had the capacity to project the eye into the bowing to be concerned about his brother. Now you know we use our imagination a great deal to try to determine why the priest and the Levite didn't stop. The times we say they were busy going to a church meeting, an ecclesiastical gathering, and they had to get on down to Jerusalem so they wouldn't be late for that meeting. At other times, we would speculate that there was a religious law that one who was engaged in religious ceremonial was not to touch a human body 24 hours before the ceremony. And every now and then we began to wonder whether maybe they were not going down to Jerusalem, down to Jericho, rather, to organize a Jericho Road Improvement Association. That's a possibility. Maybe they felt that it was better to deal with the problem from the causal root rather than to get bogged down with an individual effect. But I'm going to tell you what my imagination tells me. It's possible that those men were afraid. You see, the Jericho Road is a dangerous road. I remember when Mrs. King and I were first in Jerusalem. We rented a car and drove from Jerusalem down to Jericho. And as soon as we got on that road, I said to my wife, I can see why Jesus used this as the setting for his parable. It's a winding and meandering road. It's really conducive for ambush. You start out in Jerusalem, which is about 1,200 miles, or rather 1,200 feet above sea level. And by the time you get down to Jericho, 15 or 20 minutes later, you're about 2,200 feet below sea level. That's a dangerous road. In the days of Jesus, it came to be known as the bloody paths. You know, it's possible that the priest and the Levite looked over that man on the ground and wondered if the robbers were still around. Or it's possible that they felt that the man on the ground was merely faking. And he was acting like he had been robbed and hurt in order to seize them over there, lure them there for quick and easy seizure. And so the first question that the priest asked, the first question that the Levite asked was, if I stop to help this man, what will happen to me? But then the Good Samaritan came by, and he reversed the question. If I do not stop to help this man, what will happen to him? That's the question before you tonight. Not if I stop to help the sanitation workers, what will happen to my job? Not if I stop to help the sanitation workers, what will happen to all of the hours that I usually spend in my office every day and every week as a pastor? The question is not if I stop to help this man in need, what will happen to me? The question is, if I do not stop to help the sanitation workers, what will happen to them? That's the question.
Like Jesus, it would be advisable if I just stop and say, just let those words from Martin Luther King, this is a parable about race and fear. Until I listened to that, I never
once would have thought that. I've read it my whole life, and I never would have thought that. That interpretation is totally valid. When he introduces the Good Samaritan, he doesn't say the Samaritan. Very careful character. He says, then a man of another race came by. So he's using his historical context in the first century and his own pilgrimage to the Holy Land to generate a new meaning that is applicable to his civil rights struggle in that exact moment, which is the problem for him of the moderate. That's what he's writing about at the time, the problem of the moderate. All these good people of goodwill who are donating to the association, but they're not stopping on the street. Right? They're not using the feet for this. So for him, it's a parable where he's saying, let's not imagine ourselves as the Good Samaritan who's always helping and going through likewise, or the person in the ditch who needs salvation. But most of us are walking by, but we're not walking by because we're bad. We're walking by because we're afraid. We're human and we're afraid. And then he exhorts people to get beyond that fear through their numbers, right, through their collective action. So these parables live on. Many, many different meanings, many types of interpretations. They live on also in Judaism. And I'll conclude with a quote from Amy Jo Levine, who is a well-known Jewish scholar, similar to Josh, who studies the New Testament. And she wrote a book of her own about Jesus' parables called Short Stories by Jesus. And so as a Jewish scholar, a Jewish reader, she says, one does not need to worship Jesus as Lord or Savior for the parables to have meaning. The people who first heard him did not at first worship him. I don't worship Jesus, but I continue to return to these stories because they are at the heart of my own Judaism, she says. They are pearls of Jewish wisdom. Thank you.
Frank.
Tell us a story.
Has there been a study of how much of the parables of Jesus actually emanated from the Jewish rabbis and vice versa? I guess we view, speaking as a Jew, so I'm more familiar with that context, I guess, would there be... Are Jesus' parables unique unto him, or they find their source elsewhere?
I'll say the answer is yes. There are
many. Sure. So I've tried to isolate some of the ways in which Jesus' parable telling is distinctive. I won't say unique, but slightly different. And, like I said, they focus on the natural world and kind of the common life of characters, various characters, that I think is a little bit distinctive for him, or certainly is an emphasis for him. But there are many, a parable, for example, about a vineyard owner and day laborers and tenants. That's something that you could read in any rabbinic source, and that's a important parable that Jesus also tells. That ends with an inshall, that ends with a scripture interpretation. So there are times where he one of his parables, you could find it just right in the Midrash, in, you know, Genesis Rabbah or something like that. But I do think there are some aspects of his teaching style that were unique to him, and may have been generated from his context as a wandering peasant, basically. He was not, as far as we know, in a house of study. He didn't have that tradition of reading all the Tanaim and kind of reading through that history. So perhaps his context generated some of his distinctive teaching style.
I would only add.
Josh, you can tell me I'm wrong.
No. I would only add to that. There are only so many basic themes that occur in moral teaching. And so what I always find interesting is when I teach my students the parable of the king who abandons his wife and comes back 20 years later, I added that for a reason, comes back 20 years later and says, I'm so surprised you waited for me until, that like my learned students are like, oh, that's the story of Odysseus. Well, yes, it's the story of Odysseus. It's also the story of countless other cultural tales that talk about abandonment and reunion and so on and so forth. So it wouldn't surprise one if two people who were not from totally different cultures, but the rabbis and Jesus coming from essentially the same culture, would be drawing on similar resources in forming the parables.
So I'm going to voice a question that maybe we'll address over the course of tomorrow, if not for tonight. And I trust that for some of us it's a little unnerving. Like, where do I end and someone else begin? Like, where does Judaism end and Christianity begin, or Christianity end and Judaism begin? And the teachings of Jesus, pearls of Jewish wisdom, wait a minute. Like, where am I and who am I? And who are you? So, in the questions of similarity and difference, and where do we find ourselves? And what is it? Do we feel harmony and connection? Do we feel threatened? And how open am I to learn? And what makes us, why do we have two different religious communities? At what point were we not one community? We have, and part of that will be the study, some of the studies tomorrow together. And I also would want to know from each of you how the study of and association with Catholicism or Judaism, how has that affected your own understanding of yourself as a person of faith? Whether, how has the other impacted your own development and your own relationship with your chosen religion? So those are questions that I would want to, and for us to, it's both to you but also to us. How does it affect us learning about something which is so close and so similar and so far away? How does that impact me in my Judaism, or for some of us in our Christianity? And what does it mean to share in this study together? Is it okay if we leave those questions for unfolding tomorrow? Is that all right?
That's your homework.
And so certainly, as you sleep on these questions, more may emerge for you. And in a moment, we'll go over to Zerk. But first of all, how grateful we all are for the learning tonight. Thank you.